Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Daphne Kohler to the broadcast. Daphne is the co-founder and co-CEO of Coursera, an education company that partners with many of the top universities and organizations in the world to offer courses online for anyone to take for free. She's also the Rajiv Motwani Professor in Computer Science and the Oswald Villard University Fellow in Undergraduate Education at Stanford University. She's the author of over 180 publications. Daphne also pioneered many of the ideas that are key to Stanford's massive online education effort. Among the many awards she's won include a 2004 MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, and she was inducted into the National Academy of Engineering in 2011. Daphne has a bachelor's and a master's degree from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and a PhD from Stanford University. I recently caught up with Daphne at an airport in California, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as she discussed the promise that education technology and massive open online courses, or MOOCs, have in transforming education around the world. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. Maybe we can begin with the initial spark for the idea of Coursera.
Well, so I think it depends how far back you want to go. I mean, I've been doing work in this space for about 5 years in my role as a Stanford professor, and a lot of the critical ideas that were part of the development of this came up in that during that time frame. And these are what led to the development of those three Stanford courses that came out in the fall of 2011. Each of which had amazing, surprising enrollment of 100,000 students or more. And I think when we saw that impact, the opportunity that this opened up to provide an education to this many people at that low of a cost, I think that was what caused us to say we really have to live up to that opportunity.
Obviously now it's far beyond Stanford. How do you choose universities and professors within those universities, or the extent to which there's any choice in the opposite direction? How does that work?
So in terms of the universities, we really seek the best universities in the world to be part of this. And, you know, best is a complicated thing to define. There's some universities that are clearly world ranked, but then in many cases, there's universities that are, you know, maybe not top 50 and whatever, but really have unique and amazing content to offer that's unique to them. So now in terms of the actual topics, this is something that we typically leave to our universities to figure out, because they know who their best faculty are, and so I think it's best just to leave it to them. And looking for diversity of topics and so on and so forth.
And I know that some of your competition have focused more on topics, on courses that are very professional related, whereas your organization has chosen a much wider diet, which of course adds a number of layers of challenges potentially. But actually, before getting to that, I wanted to actually ask about that philosophically, the idea of more the merrier, not just focusing on courses that are, you know, engineering courses or computer science courses or something that more directly potentially makes a tie towards a job on the other end.
Well, I think partly it was driven by the request of our university partners. They really wanted to be able to offer education across the range of disciplines. And we agreed with them. We felt like people could benefit from education across the spectrum. We worked very hard to allow that, and I think it's turned out to our benefit for multiple reasons. First of all, you know, there's a reason we have 4 million students, because we appeal to a much broader spectrum than anybody else. We also think that people are not, you know, little pointed beings. People who like to take a course in technology often also like to take a course in poetry or in art. And so by offering them a spectrum, we really appeal to a very broad range of people. So that's another benefit. And then finally, the technology that we ended up developing for One for mostly for the humanities initially, which is the, you know, for example, peer grading methodology, where we knew we needed to do something for you know, essays and such, because you couldn't do that in a computer-based format, computer-based grading. We now see a lot of our engineering faculty and other disciplines using that same technology. So I think that was really a good thing that we did that. In some sense, it was serendipitous. We didn't realize that would happen, but it did.
And I was fascinated, Daphne, to hear more about the peer grading and even some of the self-grading, which perhaps counterintuitively, you've cited data that suggests that it's essentially as accurate as professor or TA grading. Can you talk a little bit further about how that's done and how you've determined that to be the case?
I think that let me modify that statement a little bit. I think it can be as accurate as TA grading. It really depends heavily on the quality of the grading rubric that's provided by the instructor. Good rubrics give you good results, bad rubrics give you bad results. It's very simple. So, and by the way, it'll only take you so far. I wouldn't use this technology to grade, you know, 10,000 word essays or five page mathematical derivations in quantum physics. But I think for certain kinds of essays that have a lot of factual content where the instructor is looking to get specific sort of connections, specific types of arguments and so on, I think it's an excellent way of doing grading if the rubric is well defined. And we've also found it to be quite accurate in grading for design. Because there, I mean, after all, you're doing qualitative stuff. The question is how much do you like this? How easy do you think the user experience would be, and you know, stuff like that. And again, that place where getting opinions of five people is actually quite relevant.
How you see the MOOCs, generally speaking, and Coursera more specifically, impacting universities. There are those who say, I've read that Clayton Christensen was predicting that the rise of innovative technology education is likely to put a substantial pressure such that a lot of lower echelon universities may actually go out of business. And I'm curious how you see this impacting the broader university spectrum across the country and across the world for that matter.
So I think that there are universities that are going to be at risk from this, but it's not necessarily the lower level ones. I think it's the ones that don't give careful thought to the implications of this transformation and how it impacts the value proposition that they provide to their students. Because I think for many universities, they go into this or have traditionally gone into this with the assumption that their primary value to their students is the dissemination or delivery of content. And with content becoming much more readily available, not just through us, but content is becoming more readily available, not just through Coursera, but also just, you know, through other open educational resources, through Wikipedia and whatever. It better be more than just the content that's being provided to the students, and also more than just the degree. So what are the value-added services that a university provides? Is it the support and tutoring? Is it internship experiences, the ability to get involved in research with a faculty member? I mean, there are a lot of other components of university experience that do provide huge value, but you really have to clarify that to the students and really execute on that. And universities that don't do that, they're the ones that are going to suffer.
And I suppose the same actually can extend to professors as well, couldn't it, Daphne? I mean, for those professors who've made a living for decades of giving the same lecture again and again and again, this is the sort of thing where it's going to apply some pressure to that professor to do more in terms of collaborating with students, because the lecture will be delivered once and shown a time and time again, and the real value will happen in the collaboration in the classroom as opposed to the person up on a stage talking to 100 or 200 or 300 people.
That's right, and I think that's going to require a new style of teaching that is not typically taught to anybody right now. That is, well, for that matter. So we have, we're going to have to teach new teachers how to teach, and we're going to have to change the classroom architecture to allow for this more collaborative learning in the classroom. I mean, there's a lot of changes that are going to have to be made in order to really execute on the opportunity that we're seeing here.
Can you talk a bit about how you divide your time? You're obviously still a professor. You're an academic as well as a businesswoman. And clearly you have a couple of different jobs that a lot of people would find filling their plates just to have half of your responsibilities. And so how do you divide your time between the responsibilities that you have?
And unfortunately, it's a relatively simple answer. I'm pretty much on leave right now, doing this more or less full time. I do continue occasionally to, supervise my graduate students. I did go back to Stanford half time in the spring to teach my class in the flipped classroom format. But I, most of the time I'm doing this because it is a full-time job.
Do you foresee a time where you give this up and go back into academics, or is that a decision that you leave for the future?
Fortunately, I have not been forced to make that decision yet, because I have my leave extends until March. But I think that we'll have to make that decision at some point. Right now, this is the largest impact thing that I could possibly be doing, and so I think that's the right thing for me to do. I mean, I've done, I think, relatively impactful work as a scientist, and it's something that I enjoy a lot, and I have to say that I do miss it. I miss my graduate students and such, but in terms of the number of lives that what I'm currently doing touches and the time frame at which that happens, and furthermore, I think, but maybe even most important, here in education, when you educate one person, you touch more than just that one life. You usually touch the lives of certainly their family, and in many cases even a broader circle around them, because educating one person really does virally propagate into their surroundings. And so I think the impact that we're having is even larger than the 4 million students that we've been able to touch so far.
The model that you currently have, as you pointed out, is traditionally been finding the universities and having the universities determine which professors to be involved with Coursera. Do you foresee, or have you gotten to a point at which people that are not affiliated with universities can become professors on materials in which they are experts? Does this become the sort of thing that opens up a cadre of experts to become professors of a sort in this sort of a setting?
Clearly that, the option exists. We're not currently going that route, because I think that there's a lot of support and training that the university provides to faculty to get them to the point that they become these master teachers who can teach on the platform. And I don't want to push them out of the loop. At the same time, by doing it this way, we really have a significant quality control mechanism, because the nice thing about the model that we have is if a course is offered under the, brand of a top university, then they are pretty much guaranteeing quality, because the last thing they need is a shoddy class that goes out under their brand. And so I don't need to do quality control in nearly the same way that I would have had to do if I were screening individual instructors trying to figure out whether their courses are of sufficient quality. So it's actually really helpful to me to have universities involved.
I wanted to talk to you a bit about the revenue model for the company and how you see that evolving. Obviously, you're at the point now where everything is free, or at least to take classes, it is free, and you're gaining a tremendous audience. And like a lot of technology-based startups, you're in that process of building an audience and developing your brand. Can you talk about your own vision about the evolution of the revenue model for Coursera?
So one of the revenue models that we've recently put in place at the beginning of the calendar year is what we call the signature track. It's a verified identity, a verified certificate that actually carries the university brand. We've seen increasing uptake for that in having, more and more institutions being willing to put their courses on the signature track, a larger conversion rate among students in the signature track. And so I think that it's a credential that's for a non-degree seeking student, like a continuing education professional, is a really good affirmation that they have taken the class, they've achieved competency, and they can now prove it to people. So I think, and so that's something that we made, I think, $220,000 in Q1 with a handful of courses running. In Q2, we made, I think, over $650,000, again, with a relatively small fraction of our courses running, not a handful, but certainly far from the majority. And I think it's, we have projections that show that this is going to turn into a very nice, solid revenue stream.
In addition to the revenue numbers that you've just quoted and projections, no doubt you're keeping track of, What other metrics do you monitor to gauge the progress or lack thereof in various areas of the organization as time goes on? What are the key performance indicators that you have on your personal dashboard?
We really like to track weekly activity, so weekly active uniques. And the reason we like that is activity on our site is weekly. The courses proceed at a weekly pace. So we really like that because it allows us to track a lot of different, I mean, basically it tracks retention as well as student acquisition. Somebody is taking the class and they can keep coming back the next week. That's a good sign that it's a good class, that it's a good user experience.
Are there any others that you track?
There's a whole bunch of others, but you know, I think weekly active is probably the single most important one. I mean, there's also, you know, student satisfaction. There's certainly instructor-facing metrics that we track, and internal metrics that we track, like number of bugs that are fixed and the average time to fix the bug and so on and so forth. But yeah, every organization tracks a lot of different metrics. But in terms of the sort of overall health of the site, the biggest one is weekly active.
How have the rates of completion changed over time? Do you find that the courses are becoming more or less sticky as time goes on? Do you see more or less people making it through an entire course to its conclusion?
I think the variability is not so much time-based, it's more course-based. So there are some courses that are considerably stickier than others. However, I think it's important to clarify our understanding of retention, which is very different than what typically people think about. So, you know, you think about retention in a traditional college class, the presumption is that everybody who goes in has the intention to complete the class, and if they don't, then it's a failure, somebody's failure. In MOOCs, most of the students who sign up for a class have absolutely no intent to complete it. A good half of them pretty much don't even show up on the first day. It was kind of, you know, like this whim over a bottle of beer at 11 o'clock at night saying, ooh, astrobiology, sounds cool. Seriously, and then, I mean, you know, they don't show up. And then of the ones that show up, there's a very large fraction of them that's viewing this more as a browsing experience. They, you know, watch a few lectures, look around for a while, they learn something about the topic, they feel like they walk away understanding something they didn't, but, you know, they're not really intended to do the class. And then even among the ones who are serious about the class, many of them are just not into doing homework. So they just, you know, watch the class beginning to end with doing videos only. And all of these are counted in the denominator of enrollment, but can't possibly contribute to the completion rates, and so our retention stats look ridiculously bad, even though it's actually not about retention, it's about intent. Now, if you actually look at the students who, in an entry survey, walk in and say, I am planning to complete this class, I really mean to do all the homework, so I'm highly committed to doing that, retention rate's about 84%. That's a population that's more directly analogous to what you would compare to a college class, because the people who walk into a college class are highly committed to completing the class, right?
Do you foresee a point at which this has sort of full accreditation, where people only take their university curriculum through Coursera, and at the back end of that receive a Coursera degree that's equivalent to you in some way?
No, we're not intending to become an accredited academic institution. We do hope that over the course of time, for those students who are degree seeking, that they will be able to get some of the courses articulated into degree programs at traditional academic institutions, but we're not intending to become an accredited institution ourselves.
Can you tell us a bit about your own strategy for the foreseeable future? What are some of the priorities that you're working on now? What are some of the new wrinkles to the business model that you're contemplating?
Well, I think one of our biggest priorities in the coming months, and you can see that in terms of the funders in our recent Series B announcement, was the international direction. Currently, a third of our students are in the U.S. The rest are outside. 40% are in what's called the developing world by the State Department. And we really would like to expand that fraction and expand the numbers, because we feel like that's where the gap between what currently is there and the need is so huge. And that furthermore, none of the existing solutions have the possibility of possibly addressing the problem and coming up with a solution within a generation. You cannot build capacity for education that quickly. And so we would really like to move into the international direction much more aggressively. We're looking for, you know, one of the directions we're looking at is internationalization and translation of the content. We're also looking at a mobile solutions so that students can join the class even if they don't have access to the internet 24/7, so they can basically sync up and then work on their mobile device for a few days and then come back and resync. And that will be very helpful in developing well. So there's technical directions that we're taking to support that international expansion. There's also other directions that we're looking on the more, whatever, business, if you will, side of just getting the word out to people, letting them know that this opportunity is there for them.
I was fascinated to hear a little bit more about the way in which you fostered collaboration with the students that partake of Coursera literally on all the continents, and how the data that you were quoting, that the average response to a question is something like 22 minutes, which no professor would be able to fulfill, of course, and that the extent to which people are gathering in far-flung places to describe or discuss a course they're taking from a university that's half a world away. Can you talk a bit about the way in which you foster that, or even how you've seen it grow on its own?
Humans are very social animals, and they naturally gravitate towards social experiences. And in fact, I would argue that in some sense, one of the biggest differences between what we're currently doing and previous incarnations of online learning is the way in which social is so inherently built into the experience. It's not just the students with their computer. So as you mentioned, the discussion forums are one such mechanism by which students really engage in what we call peer teaching. Because, you know, one thing that just doesn't scale is this hub and spoke model where the instructor is the only one answering questions to all of those students. And this is a much, not only much better experience, but it is also much more social. In addition, we see, and this occurred organically, students just naturally congregate into study groups that occur in, I think, about 3,000 cities around the world. People just come meet once a week and discuss the Coursera class that they're taking. If you go to meetup.com/Coursera, you'll see a map of all of our, or at least most of our study groups, I think, and get all of them on the map. So, and you can just go and take a look at it. It's pretty exciting to see the range of cities and the excitement that people exhibit about this.
Well, Daphne, thank you so much for taking a little time with me. I appreciate you fitting this into your very busy schedule.
Thanks, Peter. Bye-bye.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat believes in the power of openness and shared knowledge to transform how we all do business. Learn more at redhat.com. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.